Issue 2's Do's and Don'ts, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy, Barry Sheets. And along with me today is my co-host, Vice Chairman, good friend, and fellow analyst, Chuck Michaels.
Looking forward to doing a little analysis on the election.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, as if you've been with us this week, we are doing election wrap-up for a few programs this week. We're talking about the main statewide issues that were on your ballot, issues 1, 2, and 3. We talked about issue 1 and the turnout and why people by 62 to 38 said no to raising the age limit for judges on our benches in Ohio. Today, we're going to turn to the issue, the main event, the big attraction. And I say this because this was the issue that the largest number of votes were cast on the statewide ballot. Issue 2, the referendum on Senate Bill 5 and the collective bargaining laws of Ohio. 3.5 million voters actually cast a ballot on Issue 2 at Tuesday, November 8th election. Now, you know, if you look at it in juxtaposition to issue 1, then issue 1 was undervoted by about 7%. So 7% of the people that came out didn't bother to vote on state issue 1. They came out for issue 2. And issue 3 was a little bit more than, it was about 3.3 million. So that means at least 200,000 voters turned out to the polls specifically because of state issue 2. So it was the big issue, and I think everybody was very much aware of that, not just here in Ohio, but on the national scene as well. It was being talked about. Lots of focus was being put on this and I think, Chuck, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later. I want to talk about the issue itself first, but I think there was a lot of emphasis put on and maybe too much weight given to what the other issues underlying the turnout on issue 2 might mean.
Oh, there's way too much emphasis. I've seen some rather silly declarations that this is a repudiation of conservatism and a resurgence for President Obama.
Well, and I think we're going to explain to the folks as we talk today why we don't think that's the case, because we can look at the numbers fairly clearly. So
the reason it's silly is because right next door is issue 3, mm-hmm. which clearly went the other direction. And it was a clear repudiation of the attempt to seize control of the healthcare industry, which is exactly what Obamacare is. And I think everybody who's being honest about the situation realizes that's exactly what it's for. That's what it's been about from the beginning, is seizure of and the creation of a state-funded insurance. And when I say state, I mean United States, the state being the federal government, a state-funded healthcare system on a par, much like Canada's or maybe Britain's, and nobody wants that.
No, that's true. You know, Chuck, I was just looking at the numbers, since we're talking about the issue 2 and Senate Bill 5. It generated the most number of voters coming out to vote for it. 2.145 million of that 3.5 million voters who punched the touch screen or punched the punch card or pulled a lever. Well, I don't think we even do those last two anymore. I think it's all touch screen now. But 2.145 million cast their votes against Senate Bill 5. Because it was a referendum, so these were folks who supported the referendum on Senate Bill 5. They don't want the law to take effect. Issue 2 was defeated 61 to 39. That was the percentage difference. But 2.145 million voters cast their votes against it. 1.352 million cast their votes in favor of it. Now, why do I say that? Because I'm looking at the numbers on Issue 3, and there were more votes cast in favor of Issue 3 than there were cast against Issue 2. So obviously, that extra turnout, at least a good percentage of that extra turnout, from 3.3 million to 3.5 million, that 200,000 votes, a lot of it spread out to the yes side of Senate Bill 5. So I think as far as what happened was a lot of the votes against Issue 2, which were cast by people who were affected by it, the professional unions, the policemen, the firefighters, the teachers, and the state and municipal employees, a lot of those votes were cast probably absentee ballot, because what I was hearing across the state was that the absentee ballot was healthy this time around. So a lot of those people cast their votes ahead of time, but when it got closer and closer and finally people got all the information, you had a number of folks, the Serbs, that came out to the polls to vote in favor of Senate Bill 5. But again, just too little, too late. That was, I think, kind of the story of the support of Issue 5 all the way across the board. I know that everybody's going to say, well, I was getting mail for a month on this thing and hearing radio ads and TV, but you know what? You weren't seeing or hearing a lot from the folks who were supporting it directly.
That's right.
Up until the last couple, 3 weeks of the campaign. Now, granted, the unionized forces, the professional unions who were running the campaign against, had a 4-to-1 spending advantage. Now, we don't know specifically what the numbers finally break down to, because we won't get to see the post-election campaign finance reports on this issue until sometime in mid-December, when all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed and all the money's accounted for. Then we'll see what the spending discrepancy was and see. Honestly, I think that for those folks who supported Issue 2, who thought this law should go into effect, they were outspent heavily and only losing basically a 3-to-2 margin, because it was 61-39 again, 61% against, right, 39% for. Yeah, that's a 3-to-2 margin. So only losing 3-to-2 while being outspent 4-to-1 or better. I think that maybe toward the end, the waning days of this election, people were cutting through all of the sound bites and they were starting to look at what this issue would have really done. Now, again, too little, too late.
And that is the bottom line, because what was the main argument? The main argument was that vote no on Issue 2 people latched onto was this idea that we won't be able to negotiate for adequate staffing. Well, come on. I know that you and I discussed this and we both actually laughed at it. How often do police and fire and teachers and whatever go into a negotiation room with the idea of increasing the number of staff members? The answer is never.
Well, do they go in with wanting to do that? Well, you always hear about teachers talking about, you know, smaller teacher-student ratio in the, sure, classrooms, or more classrooms with more teachers in them. You hear about that all the time, but that's not what gets negotiated.
No, of course not, because if they have more students, then they have what they think in their minds is a justification to ask for more money and more benefits. That is really what gets negotiated. It's how much benefits can I get, how much salary can I get, and how much am I going to have to pay for my benefits? And the bottom line here is that the real problem that's facing cities and school districts and fire districts and towns and townships is not so much salaries, although in a lot of school districts like my own, Westerville, the salaries are really out of hand. The fact is that what it is benefits, and it's mostly pension funds. You know, one of the big arguments that I'm still seeing is that state employees are claiming that, yes, we do have to pay for our health insurance and our pension plans. Well, the fact is that in some cases they do, but the facts are they don't pay anywhere near what private sector employees have to pay. For instance, for my retirement and my health benefits, I pay 100%.
Yes, you do.
And not only that, but I also pay 100% of all the firemen, all the policemen, and all the teachers in my district. Well, they claim that they pay into the system. But the fact is, if they were not there, I would be paying nothing into that system and paying nothing into their retirement or into their benefit package. So the fact that they're there means that I am paying 100% of them. Now, do we have a need for policemen and firemen? I think policemen, yes. Firemen could probably be done on a volunteer basis.
And in many communities, it still is.
Yes, and probably could very easily be done. I would volunteer to be a fireman And of course, they all claim that we now the need is past the point where we can get away with, you know, volunteer firemen. I don't believe that.
Well, you're raising an interesting point here, Chuck, because I've been thinking about this as well. You know, you're talking about volunteer firemen, and then you said for paid firemen. I thought, you know what? Maybe it's a situation similar to property taxation, because that's what pays for those services. When folks, you pay your property tax. And for those of you who rent who don't think you're paying property taxes, okay, wake up. Your rent includes the taxes that the owner of the property has to pay on that property. And so every time they get a property tax increase, you get a rent increase. But the point that I'm making is, since we pay this out of our property taxes, and most people don't know how much they pay because oftentimes it's figured into their mortgage. And so when they pay the bank every month, their mortgage or the lending institution, or whomever it is, they don't ever see what the actual cost of what they're paying, you know, dollar for dollar for the services they get. Maybe it's a situation. And again, we're running into this because, you know, we've just had in the last week since last Tuesday, since voters repudiated this collective bargaining reform law, we've had the county in which the largest city in Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama, sits, file for bankruptcy. They're $3.14 billion, with a B, billion dollars in debt. Now, you know, that's going to happen here, Chuck. I'm sure if this economy is continuing on the trend that it's been on, we're going to see major cities in Ohio, and I can think of Cleveland and Toledo and Youngstown and Cincinnati, Dayton, and Columbus and Dayton and maybe even smaller communities who just won't be able to continue to tax their residents' properties or their incomes to a sufficient level to keep up with what they're giving away and are being demanded by those police and fire services or those are other services that come along and want your tax dollars. I remember having the idea of maybe contracting privately and having, you know, we talk about free market economics and everything else, but we don't seem to think about it for, say, safety services like police and fire and other provisions where, you know, whether it's in a community, the community contracts with somebody to do it and they set a rate and the community all is involved in setting the rate and not just somebody who gets tax dollars and then has it and then they set a rate with somebody who receives tax dollars.
Well, we've only got a couple minutes left.
We're going to have to basically, that's for sure, but
yeah, that's right. And unfortunately,
we're dealing with public employers and public employees. It's people who are getting paid with our tax dollars sitting on both sides of the negotiating table. That's a big problem.
Well, that's right. Yes, and the city basically hires professional negotiators to do the job for them, and so does the union. Who generally pays for the professional union negotiator is the taxpayer.
Yep.
So we're basically paying for both sides of the negotiation, and in fact, we then end up paying for, let's say they don't go and they don't get a contract and it goes to arbitration. Well, how many times in 100 does arbitration go in favor of the city? I'd love to see that statistic. I'd be willing to bet that it is about 1 in 10, that in fact 9 in 10 it goes in favor of the union who has requested the intervention.
Okay.
What that means is that basically either we pay more or the city goes bankrupt. And in fact, I think what you're going to be seeing is unions filing suit against cities and judges ordering cities to raise taxes without vote. This is not something that's unprecedented in our history.
Yeah, it's called the dreaded inside millage, and you're going to see probably the legislature opening that up for local governments more and more. Oftentimes, school districts can do it. It's called unvoted millage increases up to, like,
right.
I think it's like half a mil or maybe even up to 5 mils in certain areas, where if the local governing authority needs more money, they can, up as long as they don't go past that up end limitation, they can just slap it onto your taxes and you pay it.
And any official who votes to either allow that or call for it should be immediately recalled.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's true too, but that's an issue for another day.
That's right. We're out of time.
Folks, I know we're running out of time here. We're going to be continuing on because we want to talk more in depth about what's going on with this. So be with us tomorrow at 5:30 as we explore and analyze the issue 2 vote and some of the implications possibly nationally, of what happened last Tuesday. We'll be back tomorrow with more principles and policies.